Religion has profoundly influenced the sweeping American narrative, perhaps more than any other force in our history, from the time of the indigenous peoples to the present day. The National Museum of American Religion tells the surprising and compelling story of what religion has done to America and what America has done to religion, including the establishment of the revolutionary and indispensable idea of religious freedom as a governing principle in the U.S., inviting all to explore the role of religion in shaping the social, political, economic, and cultural lives of Americans, and thus America itself. Join us for season 3 of our podcast series, Religion and the American Experience, as we follow scholars and others deep into America's religious history and learn how it can inform and animate us as citizens grappling with complex questions of governance and American purpose in the 21st century. Episodes will be released monthly on Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Listeners, welcome to another episode of Religion and the American Experience, a podcast series of the Digital First National Museum of American Religion. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcast fix. Martin Luther King is a larger-than-life character in the American narrative, playing a pivotal role in the nation's mid-20th century civil rights movement. His I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. in August of 1963, as part of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, and his letter from Birmingham Jail are integral parts of Americans' understanding of him and the civil rights movement he led. However, talking about receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, he said, quote, "I am a minister of the gospel, not a political leader," close quote, suggesting there is more, much more, to him than the letter and the dream. This podcast episode is going to explore the religion of Martin Luther King, what it was, how it formed him, inspired him, burdened him, and animated him. Today's guest, who will help us do this, is Paul Harvey, distinguished professor of history and presidential teaching scholar at University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Paul researches, writes, and teaches in the field of American history from the 16th century to the present. He is the author of Martin Luther King, A Religious Life, Howard Thurman and the Disinherited, A Religious Biography, Christianity and Race in the American South, A History, and Bounds of Their Habitation, Religion and Race in American History. He received his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. Paul, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, especially since, as you told me before, you have COVID.
I'm glad to be here. My voice will be a little rough in this podcast. I apologize for that.
Well, thank you so much for doing it, especially since you've been sick. Before we start, Paul, into the book itself, perhaps you could share with our listeners why you wrote it, especially when there have been so many biographies of Martin Luther King.
Short answer is because I was asked to write it by the publisher. They have a series, Roman Littlefield, called Library of African American Biography. And I didn't really want to because I wanted to write about Howard Thurman. And eventually we agreed they didn't want a Howard Thurman book. So I wrote that for someone else. And they eventually agreed they would wait in line. And I said, I'll write this. If you will let me, I'm going to write the other one first. And then I'll write this one for you. So they waited a while and I eventually did it. But I thought it would be an interesting challenge to write.
Okay. And Howard Thurman, I believe, had quite a bit of influence on Martin Luther King.
Howard Thurman had a lot of influence on Martin Luther King, particularly Howard Thurman's book, Jesus and the Disinherited from 1949, was a book very close to King's heart, both metaphorically and literally, because he carried it in his suit coat. Okay. Often, because it was a book very influential in his thinking.
Maybe we need to do a podcast about that book as well, that person, Howard Thurman.
I would love to do that.
So if anybody told you, well, we have too many, or we have enough biographies of Martin Luther King, what would you tell them about this book?
Well, we have a lot of biographies of Abraham Lincoln, but people keep doing them, and they often have new things to say. In my case, I wasn't trying to write a really original biography in the sense of saying something brand new that a scholar wouldn't know, but I wanted to communicate what scholars have been researching about King and to digest that and synthesize it for a general reading audience, particularly a student audience, so that they would know that the King that they thought they knew is not that person, that scholars have a very different view than, let's say, that the popular view. And sometimes it's, I think it's the role of a certain kind of scholar sometimes to communicate to a broader audience the findings of a field. Okay. And I've done that with a couple of different books, including this one.
Now, this is a religious biography. Are there others like that, or is this sort of new, focusing on his religious outlook?
There are books that certainly analyze him as a religious thinker. Often they're written by philosophers and religious studies scholars. To have one like this by a historian, I guess the closest one would be one by Jonathan Bass some years ago, which was about Letter from a Birmingham Jail, and a couple of books by, I forgot his name now, I'm sorry, the author who wrote about Jonathan Reeder, that's it, who wrote a book about Letter from a Birmingham Jail as well. But not that many, really.
Okay. Well, the museum appreciates this particular biography because it emphasizes and helps us understand his religion. So thank you for writing it. First off, can you tell us about the religious lives of his parents, Alberto Williams and Michael King, and their religious influence on their son, Martin Luther?
Sure. Alberto Williams came from the family who ran the Ebenezer Baptist Church. Michael King was this is in Atlanta. Michael King, his father came from Southwest Georgia, moved to Atlanta. He grew up in a very rough kind of way and kind of escaped a difficult family situation and began to go to college at Morehouse College and began to court Alberta Williams. It took several years for him to convince her to marry him. Alberta Williams was the roommate of Sue Bailey Thurman, Howard Thurman's wife, actually, at Spelman Seminary in the early 1920s. And Michael King was one of these kind of young men of very poor backgrounds who really used the African-American church as a vehicle for social mobility and eventually took over the Ebenezer Baptist Church and made it into the very important institution that it is. Let's say that Michael King's background was not really very religious because he came from a dysfunctional family, actually. Alberta Williams, much, much more so. So there's a little bit about the complicated way in which Martin Luther King's family was formed.
With Alberta Williams, her religion, you said even more so, not dysfunctional, but
more so in the sense that she grew up as a church woman, okay. someone born and raised in the church, more so than I think Michael King, who became that sort of transformed himself to be that kind of person a little bit later in life, and did so partly because he was courting Alberta Williams, and Williams kind of tested him to see if he could come up to her standard.
And was she Baptist then?
Yes, they were all Baptist. That's right.
Okay. And as far as their influence on their children, their religious influence, what did that home life look like as far as, you know, sharing faith, sharing religion, teaching religion to their children?
So Martin Luther King Jr., he was born Mike King, like his father, but they both changed their name to Martin after a trip to Germany in 1934 and decided Martin Luther was the obvious choice for a name. Martin Luther King Jr. grew up as a completely ensconced in the church, he was a kind of a star child of the church, sang in the church choir. In fact, when he was 9 years old, he sang at the opening premiere of Gone with the Wind, which they could not attend, the actual premiere, but they could stand outside and sing. And he did so as a young boy in the choir. Martin Luther King was busy planning church services when he was a boy and was a very devout and one might say, almost pathologically religious young man. I say that because he had some suicidal thoughts as well when he was young. And I don't talk that much about that in the book, but it's something that other scholars have talked about. But absolutely a church boy, almost predetermined to be a Baptist minister, which of course is what he became.
Okay. Can you paint for us a picture of Martin Luther King? And maybe you just did, but as he grew from boy to young adult and going off to Morehouse, any evidence of religious thinking that was outside the norm?
Not so much outside the norm, but the one thing is he grew up in the Black church par excellence. And Ebenezer Baptist Church had become kind of a center of African-American religious life in Atlanta, largely thanks to the skill of his father in building that church. And Martin Luther King later described it as fundamentalist, and it was in a way. But, you know, the thing that I found in researching that is that Martin Luther King's father brought all of these amazing speakers to the pulpit of Ebenezer Baptist Church. For example, W.E.B. Du Bois, who was an atheist, but was the best-known Black intellectual in the country. All kinds of other people like that were passing through Martin Luther King's life. So I think he was exposed to a broad array of African-American thought. He later told the story that he had to escape the shackles of his fundamentalism. That's how he kind of felt it. It was he had a kind of a young life rebellion against his father, and he wanted to show that he could be his own man and wasn't restricted by the rules of the Baptist church. So he could go to the pool hall, for example, when he was seminary and play pool. That was something that would have been prohibited when he grew up. But in fact, I think his background was much more complicated than he told about in his own words.
Okay. Now, for our listeners, can you give us a quick synopsis when you say he was this star child of the Black Baptist Church? What does that look like theologically in brief? I mean, what does that mean religiously?
So it means, for one thing, it means that he was firmly ensconced in the world of what we would now call evangelicalism. Evangelical has come to be a term that basically means white evangelicals, but historically that's not what it meant in the sense of a real conviction of Jesus as the savior of the world and the necessity of a conversion experience, the necessity of inviting others to experience that kind of conversion experience. This is all part of the world in which he grew up, and it was understood that this was the right path of life that one should aspire to. Of course, Black people could not be much involved in politics, and they had very limited opportunities in various other parts of life. But the church is where someone who was very ambitious could, like King's father, experience social mobility and become an important person in the African-American community.
Okay. And I think also I read that part of this growing up in that Black church was there was some social gospel aspects. That is, the church was seen in general terms as a way to, in various degrees, of course, but push, make progress for Blacks in America politically. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's completely accurate, in part because there weren't any other there wasn't much other option for African Americans looking for institutions that could advance their interests. The church was clearly the most important place where that was going to happen. And so whites were divided between those who emphasized kind of the church as an evangelical space, very much a private idea of religion, and social gospel churches that emphasized the church as a institutional place to advance social progress. African Americans did not have that division very much. They were very much a little bit, but they were mostly, the churches were clearly places where both could happen.
Okay, that's important to understand. You report that Martin's sister said of his decision to become a preacher, quote, "It was not the Lord, but the hot sun of the tobacco fields that called him to the ministry," close quote. Can you share how Martin came to the decision to go into the ministry? I mean, was there some truth in that? Or, as you said before, was he predestined, or did he know this is what he wanted to do from a young age?
Yeah, She was referring to a summer that Martin Luther King spent in 1944 working in the tobacco fields of Connecticut. It's the first time he had been out of the South, actually. And he experienced a different world because he was living in the North and it wasn't the same kind of segregated life. But no, that quote, the hot sun of the tobacco fields, that comes from African-American folklore. It's a kind of joke about Black ministers that they discover their call to preach when they have a really hard job out in the hot fields. They start thinking about what could be a better thing to do with my life than this. So okay. It's an old joke in Black American folklore that she was kind of repeating. But in fact, as I said, I think Martin Luther King's life was almost predetermined that that's who he was going to be. And I'm not sure that there was ever one moment of decision. I think that he was kind of always already there.
Okay. Right. You say that in the book, I believe. So now, while studying after Morehouse at Crozer Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania, where he went to become a preacher, Martin wrote in a paper that Jeremiah, the Old Testament prophet, was, quote, a shining example of the truth that religion should never sanction the status quo, close quote. This seems important to his developing religious understandings, or maybe it was always part of them. Can you elaborate on this idea of church never being something to sort of accept the status quo?
Yeah, so as I said, he grew up with all kinds of speakers coming through his church. So he and his father was, in fact, a political activist in Atlanta. And so Martin Luther King always had that kind of idea that the church would push back against social injustice. So he came to Crozer Theological Seminary. He was 19 years old, by the way. He entered Morehouse College at 15 years old. He sort of went to high school and college at the same time at Morehouse, went on to Crozer Theological Seminary. And the first thing he wrote there was, quote, I am a profound advocator of the social gospel. He wrote that when he was 19 years old in a theological paper. And that's who he was. And he understood the church as a place where a profound advocator of the social gospel could make an impact.
Okay. Were his mom and dad sort of in solidarity with him on that? Was that their religious approach?
No. His father was very much opposed to it. So his father famously resisted King's interest later in going to theological to get his PhD at Boston University. And he said he didn't want his son becoming a communist. His father pushed back against King's movement. But as King became his own person, his father eventually completely embraced it. By the time he finished his PhD, he was very, very proud of his son. So they had a little bit of a conflict, but they got over it.
Okay. So we'll talk a little bit more about the social gospel, I guess.
If I can just add one more point on that previous point. What his father worried about was that King would become so educated that he would not be able to return to a Southern pulpit and talk to the people. So when he said he was afraid he was becoming a communist, that's actually what he meant, that he would have all these highfalutin theological ideas and not be able to speak to the ordinary domestic servant, for example, or the ordinary Black worker in a place like Montgomery. It turns out that was not the case. King was brilliant at doing that. But that's what his father worried about, I think.
You mentioned this, King Martin Luther King escaping from the shackles of fundamentalism earlier. But maybe you can explain to our listeners what that really means. What is fundamentalism? What was he leaving, and did he leave it completely?
Yeah, so fundamentalism to King, what he meant was a kind of idea that the Bible is true in every literal word. He very much grew up with that kind of thing, and he was exposed to Northern liberal theological ideas and modernist ideas of theology, and he very much accepted that. And so he learned the brilliance of King, I think, is that he learned to translate that kind of modernist theology in a way that Black parishioners in the South, who would have no idea where all these ideas came from, could understand.
Right. Okay. So, Paul, Martin wrote of his ministerial hopes, quote, let us continue to hope, work, and pray that in the future, we will live to see a warless world, a better distribution of wealth, and a brotherhood that transcends race or color. This is the gospel I will preach to the world, close quote. And in this same chapter of your book, Paul, you mentioned that he saw nationalism as a sin. So saw nationalism in religious terms as a sin. How unique was this combination of things in a Black American studying to become a preacher in mid-20th century?
Pretty unusual, I would say. Pretty unusual. Martin Luther King was pretty much was to the left always of his class, to the left politically, I mean. And so I wouldn't say he saw nationalism as a sin. I think he saw the way that American nationalism worked as a sin. That is to say, okay, the deification of the nation state was obviously a sin in his eyes, because the nation state was one that had perpetrated racial inequality for virtually its entire history, for example. So it could not be deified, obviously, in his view.
Right. And you mentioned a few minutes ago about his father worrying that he was would become a communist. There was that accusation throughout Martin's life. He was left of center, left of people, most people he was with. But he always said that the thing he didn't like about communism, why he rejected it, was its atheism. Can you tell us a little bit about his theological wrestling with communism?
I don't think he wrestled much at all with it. I mean, to him, there were certain attractions to certain communist ideas, but what he did is he translated them into what he became, which is a social democrat of the kind that one would see in Western Europe, Sweden, or someplace like that. And that is to say, he believed in democracy, he believed in religion, and he believed in equalizing incomes and certain socialist ideas. And he looked to the communist world and he saw it correctly as, first of all, being based on atheism, totally unacceptable, and secondly, anti-democratic. And he didn't have the kind of fantasy that some other people did, that there could be such a thing as democracy in the Soviet communist world. He never thought that.
Okay. While pursuing his PhD in systematic theology at Boston University, he studied personalism. Can you explain to our listeners what that is and what it meant to him?
Yeah, so personalism was a kind of a mid-20th century, very popular philosophy, very important at Boston University, which exalts the human personality as in touch with the divine. And so personalism is the kind of idea that the human personality is an expression of the divine. And that was something that he was very much attracted to, I think, because it was the exact contrary of how African Americans were viewed in the South, and that is to say, they were subjugated in a way which held that their souls did not have equal value. That was the historical white theological racism in America, and personalism was really like the exact opposite of that. I think that's why it had a profound impact on him.
Was this personalism something that would have been understood back at Ebenezer, where he grew up?
I do think it would be understood, not with the fancy philosophical terms, but with the language that historically had come from the Black church, which was full of phrases that were kind of, let's say, folk expressions of personalism, I think. I think That's why he also responded to it.
Okay. How would you summarize, Paul, the influence of his time at Boston on Martin's religion and religious outlook?
First of all, it squarely placed him in the world of modernist theology. He left behind the kind of strict evangelical fundamentalist, as he called it, a vision that he had grown up with. And so he was very much always a part of that world. He also worked very closely there with white professors, one of whom followed his career pretty much from that point forward. And I think he came to understand that there could be a real human community between white and Black people. I'm not sure that he really had ever experienced that before in his life, before he had that chance a little bit at Crozer. I think, but also very much more so at Boston University, where he was a star student, and his professors loved him. Mm.
And when he's squarely in the middle of modernist theologies in America at that point, the religious groups back in the South that he would interact with so much, I think you talked a bit about this, but he used language with them and in his work that didn't necessarily reflect that sort of modernist thought. He was one of them in the South, right? He was one of them in those churches. Mm-hmm. There were differences perhaps in their theologies, maybe mostly minor, maybe some major, but that did not cause friction, did it, in his work as a minister of the gospel and activist in the South? Or did it?
No, one of the major themes in my book is that King's major genius, in my view, was knowing how to transmit ideas, complicated, rich, philosophical ideas in a language that a person with a sixth grade education could understand. And I think he was astonishingly powerful at doing that. And people responded to that. They knew immediately. When he started his first pulpit, in Montgomery, that they had found that kind of person, and they loved him for it.
Okay, we are talking with Paul Harvey, distinguished professor of history and presidential teaching scholar at University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, and the author of Martin Luther King: A Religious Life. Listeners, be sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Paul, now moving past his young life and education, when Martin started at Dexter Avenue in Montgomery as a new pastor, I think in 1955 or thereabouts, he was determined to change things. You write that, quote, he did not want a dead middle-class social club with a thin veneer of religiosity, close quote. Indeed, as Martin himself wrote, quote, our church is becoming militant, stressing a social gospel as well as a gospel of personal salvation, close quote. What is going on here, Paul?
I think what's going on is King was putting together the two parts of the evangelical gospel and the social gospel that the Black church historically had put together. And he was bringing it to a church in Montgomery that was very much a church of the elite of Black Montgomery. And by elite, I mean people who came from professional classes and doctors and lawyers and teachers, a lot of teachers in this church, for example. It was a very relatively well-educated congregation. And what he told them was that, I expect you guys to step up to the plate to, first of all, build the church. And he had all kinds of clubs and plans to raise money for the church and to improve the church plan and to increase its membership and so forth and so on, but also to be very much involved with pushing for the right to vote in local elections, for example, and for improving Black life in Montgomery. And so, not surprisingly, he became later the head of the Montgomery Improvement Association, because he had identified himself early on as someone who wanted to move the church in that direction.
Do you think this was something that new for the congregants to hear from their pastor? Was it jarring, or was it they'd heard before?
It was not new. It was probably jarring. It was not new because the previous pastor had been this very outspoken man named Vernon Johns. Vernon Johns has a very long and interesting history. But Vernon Johns loved to pick and prod at the congregants for being too comfortable. And so he would bring like vegetables to the pulpit and say, you guys need to be growing your own food. And he would bring that to the pulpit and would kind of make fun of them for being a little too uppity, if you will, to get their hands in the soil. So they had heard that. Johns was a little too much that way, which is why they kind of shoved him out. And King was not that way. He was a little more polite, let's say, in bringing these kinds of things. But he also knew how to talk to people in a way that would get them active.
Okay. And so the social gospel and personal salvation, marrying those two or hearing of those two together wasn't new to them either.
No, it was absolutely not new to them. Absolutely not. No.
Okay. Okay. In the days after Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat there in Montgomery on a bus in December of 1955, as the one-day bus boycott was extended, you write, Paul, that, quote, supporters came to the Dexter Avenue Church for a mass meeting. One participant, Joanne Gibson Robinson, recounted how she felt that certainly the spirit from above must have been among the crowd, for people were mentally, spiritually, psychologically serene inside. Close quote. A white friend wrote Martin, telling him, quote, that although the White Citizens Council would meet that night, they can't make you ride and you are not breaking any law, so continue in the spirit of Christ. He is your real leader. Don't forget him, close quote. Can you tell us how Martin became involved and how religion played a role in his initial involvement?
Sure. So this was supposed to be a one-day boycott, and they met at the end of the one day, and Martin Luther King gave this is actually at the Holt Street Baptist Church. I think I might have miswrote that in the book. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So then he gave a very famous speech, which we know in part because the FBI was there recording it. Scholars were able to transcribe it. And people were so inspired by that speech that it became clear that this was going to go on much longer than just one day. And so they began planning. And so then the question was, who's going to be the head of this movement? And Martin Luther King did not come to Montgomery exactly intending to do that, but he had already become the spokesperson. And so it was kind of natural that he would be thrust up. Also because, as various other local labor leaders, for example, E.D. Nixon, who was a member of the church and was a labor leader, said famously, the city fathers had not put their hand on Martin yet, meaning they had not co-opted, the white leaders of Montgomery had not yet co-opted him into the system, because he hadn't been there long enough. He was too young. He was only 24 years old. And so he was kind of perfect for the role. Even though he had come to Montgomery, he was trying to finish his PhD dissertation, he was trying to stay away from this kind of stuff, but it was almost inevitable that he would be become the spokesperson and the leader. He was the right person at the right time. Everybody knew that.
So when you say in time, black pastors would become co-opted by the white power structure, what does that mean? How did that look like?
What it looked like was to say, hey, what do you guys need? Do you guys need some help in improving your church property outside? And maybe the city can throw in some money with that. But the understanding, the quid pro quo, was essentially that you will go along with the city plans, and you're not going to make trouble, are you? You're not going to be an agitator, are you? And that's historically a lot of prominent black urban churches had been co-opted to be sort of co-participants in effectively preserving the segregated structure, preserving the peace, as white city administrators would have put it. But preserving the peace meant preserving a basically unjust system. And King was not going to do that. That's one thing that was different about Martin Luther King than others of his ilk.
Did that ever come to the fore in his father's time at Ebenezer?
His father was also not like that. So King wanted to get away from the fundamentalism of his father, but his father was very much a political activist as well. So I think King inherited that as part of his family's tradition.
Did when black preachers, for example, Martin Luther King's father, didn't go along with this sort of co-opting, I mean, there was a danger to that, probably, right? And people sort of all knew that. And so it was a fine line. It was very delicate, right? It's a very delicate matter. And people would be very sensitive to this, I'm assuming. What's going to happen? You know, what is the black church? Is it going to be a safe place for me in the status quo, or will it shed some of that safety to make some advances. Were those thoughts in parishioners' minds?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other reason is because everybody knew that if you go along, maybe you'll get some certain kind of benefit from the city or whatever. And if you don't go along, you're subjecting yourself to violent attacks. And of course, King did that, and he was subjected to violent attacks for pretty much his entire adult life at various times, including his house being bombed in Montgomery.
Right. Okay. Can you tell us the story about what happened to Martin Luther King in his kitchen on January 27th, 1956?
Yeah, so this is about 6 weeks or so into the Montgomery bus boycott. And not surprisingly, he was constantly being peppered with hate calls at home and people calling up and saying really nasty stuff to him and threatening violence and so forth. And it was wearing on him. I mean, he I'm not sure that he fully realized the extent of hate that he was going to be subjected to. And he felt almost at a moment of giving up, and he had a kind of religious vision at that moment that God was going to be with him always. And he spoke about this. To the degree he ever had a conversion experience in his life, it was this. He didn't have like the traditional conversion experience of becoming a Christian. And he kind of said that just never happened to me because I grew up in the church and I didn't need it. But he had a kind of conversion experience that he had to decide whether he was going to accept the leadership role that had been thrust upon him somewhat in a haphazard way. Nobody expected that to happen exactly at that moment. It was a series of accidents that made it happen that way. But he had to decide whether to accept it. And he knew by accepting it, he was going to put his family in danger. And indeed, 3 days later, after this kitchen table experience, was when his house was bombed. And the whole family miraculously survived. Nobody got hurt, but just luckily, nobody got hurt, really. When that happened, a crowd gathered and they were ready to rumble. They were angry, and King told them to go home and be peaceful. It was a key moment in his message of nonviolence, because he was put to the test at that moment, and he stuck true to his principles.
Okay, thank you for that. Martin Luther King said, you spoke of nonviolence there. Let's get into that a bit. Martin Luther King said that Christ gave the civil rights movement its goals, and Gandhi gave it its tactics. Can you elaborate on that for our listeners?
Yes. So this was sort of King's message that he... had gotten, there was a long history of African-American interaction with Gandhi and the civil rights movement. I write about this in the Howard Thurman book, because Thurman was a key person who put these together. So King had been very much influenced by younger people, James Lawson in particular, a Methodist minister who had spent some years in India, and who came back and was very influential in introducing Gandhian ideas. And so King's idea was that to advance the progress of American civilization, of equal rights, of social justice, and of the true meaning of Christianity, but to do so in a way that would use the means that Mahatma Gandhi had used in India, that is a mass movement of nonviolent civil disobedience. And that the power of bringing those two together could transform a nation.
Okay. Again, reminding me we should do an episode about Howard Thurman. Would you give us a brief synopsis of the creation of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Martin's role in creating that?
Yeah, so the Southern Christian Leadership Conference came about. It was the successor to the Montgomery Improvement Association. And the idea was that the Montgomery bus boycott seemed to be the turning point of creating what we would now call the civil rights movement, and that there would need to be a kind of permanent organization above and beyond just the local stuff that was going on in Montgomery. And so they picked a bigger, more universal name, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But note that it was Southern and that it was Christian. as well as leadership conference, indicating the kind of personnel involved and indicating the kind of philosophy that it would pursue. So that was formed in, I believe it was 1957 officially, if I'm remembering correctly, and it became the vehicle by which King pursued his civil rights career.
Okay. Southern and Christian and leadership. Okay. Going back to nonviolence, I probably should have asked this question right after the one I did before, SCLC. Martin said this about nonviolence. Of course, nonviolence is what Martin is known for in the civil rights movement of really, and that story you say of the night his house was bombed is very poignant when he was tested with violence on a large scale and people were ready to be violent on his behalf. He said, go home. Martin said this regarding nonviolence that I thought was significant. Quote, history is replete with the bleached bones of nations who refuse to listen to the words of Jesus on this point, close quote. And I guess there are two thoughts here. And that nonviolence sought to redeem, not conquer, one's enemies. Can you give us a little bit more about how, and tell our listeners how they should understand or view Martin's outlook here with nonviolence?
So this is part of where he merged Christianity and Gandhiism. And I think it's also came from his personalism that we talked about earlier, that he had studied at Boston University. If the human principle is in touch with the divine, then even our enemies have to be respected because they have that same spark of the divine in their human personality. And our enemies are redeemable through love. And that doesn't mean we have to like them, but it means that we have to love them because loving them can redeem them. Conquering them violently doesn't serve the same kind of purpose, and thus history is replete with the bleached bones of those nations who thought that violent conquering would do away with your enemies. And what it does is it simply makes your enemies hate you all the more.
Was he challenged religiously on this idea of bringing nonviolence to violence? Did some religious leaders and others bring religious arguments to bear that said, hey, when there's violence, we need to react with violence?
Yeah, so King was very influenced by Reinhold Niebuhr, the Protestant theologian, one of his primary influences, in fact. And Reinhold Niebuhr was a kind of neo-Orthodox theologian, that is to say, skeptical of the social gospel, and saw that sometimes nation states had to do evil things to prevent more evil things from happening. Thus, you have to bomb German cities to prevent the expansion of Nazism and so forth. So King was very influenced by that because he understood that human evil existed, but he came to disagree with Niebuhr because Niebuhr could not understand King's idealism on this point about nonviolence. There was some resistance there. The bigger resistance came a little bit later, mostly, and that is from African-Americans who said that there's a book that came out some years ago called "This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed," by actually a son of someone who was involved in the civil rights movement. And this is a quote that someone in Mississippi had said, I'm not sure what year, but basically it's all well and good for King sitting at his comfortable pulpit to talk about nonviolence, but here in rural Mississippi, the nonviolence means that someone's going to come shoot you and you have no way to defend yourself. So I'm going to have my gun here to defend myself. So that's a very, very common idea among Black rural Southerners in particular, and not so much a religious idea, but just sort of the practical idea that you have to have a gun in your house, otherwise you have no way to defend your family, that kind of thing.
Right. As the civil rights movement went forward, you write, Paul, that, quote, for a number of white Protestant mainstream ministers, the language of therapy and healing nearly supplanted the historic themes of sin and redemption. That was not the case for King, close quote. Tell us more here, Paul. This seems, by my reading, quite a significant finding.
Yeah, so I think what's important there is that King had this training in personalism, and he had all these ministers that he had studied, popular ministers like Harry Emerson Fosdick, a popular minister in New York in the early 1920s, kind of liberal minister, and various others from the 19th century. But a lot of Protestant theology in the mid-20th century is moving towards a certain kind of therapeutic language. And King could do that, but King also understood that there was such a thing as sin. And he carried always that evangelical language of sin and what was necessary to overcome evil, and that people really would do bad things if they were given the power to do bad things. So, for example, he was often confronted with the idea, shouldn't we just change the hearts and minds of men, because we can't get over racism unless we change the hearts of men. And he would always say, I can't change the hearts of men, but I can restrain that man from lynching me. And that was always his response to that, and that sometimes the power of the state can restrain the evil that are in men's hearts. And this is why I think he never fully succumbed to this language of therapy, because he always understood human evil at a profound level.
Right. Okay. One favorite theme that he borrowed from another preacher, and I think it was Fosdick, mentioned, was that Jesus was, quote, maladjusted, close quote. What did Fosdick mean? What did Martin Luther King mean when he used it, and how did he use it?
Yeah, so he used it almost as a parody of the therapeutic language, like maladjusted is supposed to be bad. But, you know, Jesus was maladjusted because he lived in an unjust society. And so the point, a man with a sense of justice will be maladjusted to a society that is unjust. And maladjustment in this case is a healthy response to the social evil that we confront.
I see. Okay. Paul, you write that King saw, quote, Jesus as an emblem of the dispossessed, which was why Jesus was so central to African-American religious history, close quote. Can you elaborate on this for our listeners?
So he got that dispossessed language straight out of Howard Thurman, Jesus and the Disinherited, and had so completely absorbed that book that he just practically repeated it in some of his sermons. And adapted it and so forth. And what he meant was the same thing that Howard Thurman meant, which was that Jesus was a Palestinian Jew living under the subjugation of the Roman Empire. And there was so many obvious parallels to Black Americans living in the American Empire, and the same kinds of subjugations that people in the ancient world were subject to were those that Black Americans were also subject to. So there was a direct parallel in this view.
Okay. In your chapter entitled The Dream, the Letter, the Nightmare, you wrote this, quote, Jesus as an extremist was a common theme in his addresses, Martin Luther King's addresses, and that he reframed it with the message of redemptive nonviolence and agape love. His prophetic sermons portrayed both a God of love and a God of wrath, a familiar figure to generations who had grown up with Black sermons. America, in this view, was a nation in need of redemption, not a redeemer nation, close quote. Paul, can you try to unpack all of this for our listeners? This is a very meaningful part of what you wrote in your book, sort of identifying who he was and what his message was.
So, first of all, the word extremist. So a common theme in political rhetoric in the 1950s was to condemn extremists on both sides, by which we meant the Klan on the one side and the civil rights movement on the other side. And you could see that this is positing in a morally parallel universe two things that are not morally parallel at all. And so an extremist against the Klan is not an extremist. It's a maladjusted person who is properly an extremist against social injustice, just as Jesus was in his days. And so he's valorizing the word extremist and kind of rescuing it from the cliches that were common in the in the 1950s. So that's part of it. And the other part of it is the long history of the... Yes.
Can I interrupt and ask you a follow-up question on that, on the extremism? Was there... So as far as being an extremist against the civil rights or seeing civil rights movement as an extreme movement, were those calls coming from many places, including, and I think the answer is yes, including places of faith?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And so we'll get to this later, but the letter from a Birmingham jail, for example, was another famous attempt to say, what you call extremist is in fact completely within the Christian tradition of organizing against injustice.
Okay, we will get to that. So yeah, go on to your next point.
And the other point is that there's a long history of the Black Jeremiah. Jeremiah comes from the book of Jeremiah, and it means a lamentation against the sins of a nation. And so really from the early 19th century forward, there had been a strong Black Jeremiah against the sins of racial injustice in American history. And King was perfectly capable of preaching those same kinds of sermons that he had grown up with and that he was familiar with from his studies of the Black church. And so in that case, America is the land in need of redemption, not a redeemer nation. So the common Protestant idea is that America is the redeemer nation that will redeem kind of the world out there, and Black Americans, of course, never thought that because that's not the America that they experienced. They experienced a nation in need of redemption.
Okay, well put. Now let's get to the letter from Birmingham Jail. Paul, maybe you can give our listeners a little bit of religion on that letter. What I read in a book that, and I think you said that Martin Luther cast himself, like explicitly was thinking of himself like Paul in prison. I'm not sure if that was what you said, but maybe touch on that and anything else, and a few things in that letter that have some deep religious roots or religious or ties to religion.
Yeah, so King had long planned to write this letter because it was so obvious. Like, if you're going to put a civil rights leader like King in jail, then it is just like putting the Apostle Paul in the New Testament in jail, and then Paul will write letters to communicate to his audience out there. And so King was very aware that the parallel was kind of perfect to condemn a nation for what it was doing to suppress the civil rights movement. And so he had given some sermons previously about you know, if Paul was in jail today in the South, what kind of letter would he write? So he had been thinking about this for a long time, and so the letter from Birmingham Jail was kind of like the city government of Birmingham provided King the perfect opportunity that he had been waiting for to write. It could have been a letter from jail, many other jails that people were in, happened to be in Birmingham, so it became the letter from a Birmingham jail. But it's such an important document in American history to me. It's like the top five documents in American history: Declaration of Independence, Gettysburg Address, letter from a Birmingham jail. I mean, these were all in the same category in my view. But part of it is because it's such a profound exploration that, and you see all of the different influences, the intellectual influences, the Niebuhrian, Reinhold Niebuhr influences that he quotes in the letter, his biblical study, his studies from the Black church. It's a synthesis of his entire religious thought that comes through. And it's also King's statement that he really thought that the white South would be convicted of its sin and that it could sort of overcome its racial history. And what he's saying in when he writes this in the summer of 1963 is that, I'm done with that. Okay, you guys have had your chance and you're not doing that. In fact, you're doing just exactly the opposite. And so it's another kind of conversion experience as he's moving on his political trajectory, that his faith in what he thought people could, the conclusions that they could come to rationally just wasn't there, and that something else would have to happen in order to bring social justice. And it was really his statement that of a kind of philosophical turning point that he had come to.
Am I right in remembering that he addressed white church leaders, or was it just white?
Yeah, so it's written specifically in response to a Good Friday statement that eight ministers and one Jewish rabbi in Birmingham put out. And basically what they were saying was, please don't do this because, you know, we have the city government of Birmingham. There were actually two city governments, and they just had this election. And, you know, if you just give us a chance, we can get rid of Bull Connor, and we're going to put some really nice people, and then we can kind of sit down and have a dialogue together. And, you know, if you will just trust us white moderates to do the right thing. And King said, I don't trust you to do the right thing because I've been waiting for you to do the right thing my entire life. It's not going to happen. And so the letter is his condemnation that, as he famously says, the word wait always means never. And when he wrote that, that's because that's what he had experienced. He had waited for them to do the right thing. And the word wait means wait forever for something that's not going to happen. And so that's why our protest has to go forward, in spite of the fact that I know that you are moderates and I know that you're not the Klan, but in fact, you are a greater obstacle to the civil rights struggle for social justice than is the Klan itself.
Did he ever, I'm sure he did, but did his frustration with, white religious leaders ever, I mean, They in some ways, well, there was a Jewish rabbi in this group, but aside from him, these were Christian ministers, right? Ministers of the Christian gospel, as he was.
Correct.
He must have gotten very, you know, obviously frustrated that they come to such different conclusions when they worship the same person, right? Did this come out? I think we need to do an episode about the letter from Birmingham Jail all by itself, and the religion in it, right? The religious thoughts in it. But what was his frustration? How did he express his frustration with that?
I think his frustration was that he said, he starts the letter off very nicely and says, I'm sorry for disturbing your busy schedule and so forth. But by the time he gets to about halfway through, he shifts and says, when you guys talk about waiting and that we can come to have a peaceful dialogue, what are you going to tell my daughter when I take her to the amusement park and she's not allowed to get on the ride and I can see the tears welling up in her eyes? And he has a whole very famous passage in which he ventilates about what the personal experiences of African Americans are actually like and why they cannot wait anymore for the white South to do the right thing, which is just not going to happen. And he really, in a way that he had never fully done before, I think before then, just lets them have it about what life is really like.
Okay. Well, let's move on. In the interest of time, we could talk here for a long time about that letter. It was 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, I Have a Dream speech. Coretta King, his wife, said, quote, at that moment, it seemed as if the kingdom of God appeared, but it only lasted for a moment, close quote. Paul, can you share the religion that he preached that day and what it did and did not do briefly?
Yeah, so very briefly, the first part of the speech is about how America owes a large debt to African Americans that it has not paid. And he famously says the check was sent back saying insufficient funds, meaning that the Black American has never got his due. And so he was talking about all this, and this was the March for Jobs and Justice, and it was a very much an economic arts and economic themed speech, but then very late in the speech, famously, he transitions to the "I have a dream" part, and the "I have a dream" part becomes the part that everyone remembers. But I think what's important to say about the "I have a dream" part is it's based on the dream can only happen in a world of economic justice. And that's the part that nobody remembers anymore, and that has been oversimplified in the sanctified accounts of that day. And it's something that frustrates and irritates scholars every year on King Day, that the speech has been balderized to mean pretty much the opposite of what, in fact, King meant at the time.
Yeah. That does come out in your book, and I think that's important that you said that here on the podcast. What did King consider that a sermon?
A sermon? No, I don't think he intended it as a sermon. Maybe a civil religion sermon. I mean, it's adopted now as part of American civil religion. He probably meant it that way to a certain degree. But I think it's one of King's things was to leave people at the end with a kind of vision of like a better world to come. And of course he was famous and brilliant at doing that. And great orators do that. They leave you not only with, you know, a lot of complex ideas about the situation that we're facing, but also like what kind of world we can have if we can overcome the situation we're facing and get to that place.
Right. Why did Coretta say that it seemed as if the kingdom of God had come, but it only lasted a minute?
Oh, she was looking at the crowds, a crowd of 250,000 people, and the whole thing, nobody knew if this was going to work. That nobody knew if, you know, even people were going to show up or not. Whether it was going to, you know, there would be fights or violence or something like that. Right. Instead, you had this magnificent day that has come down to us in kind of the national religious myth of, you know, people getting together. Howard Thurman was there in the crowd, by the way, and he said exactly the same thing. Like, I had a vision for, like, this was my vision of what maybe the world could be one day. He said exactly the same thing that Coretta Scott King said. But, of course, that's one day, and the next day is a work day, and the same problems that were there before were still there.
In the late 1960s, framed by Martin's opposition to the Vietnam War, which he felt God called him to do, his dream of a poor people's campaign, and his support of the garbage workers' strike in Memphis, you write that, quote, King often cast himself as the suffering Jesus, ready to lay down his life. Later, he increasingly cast himself as an Old Testament prophet who expressed the wrath of God for the sins of society, close quote. Where was his religion taking him towards the end of his life, and why?
I think his religion was taking him to universalizing his vision of social justice. So the Poor People campaign was supposed to be a completely interracial campaign involving the white working class and the black working class, for example, and poor people everywhere. And a transformational idea of what would be necessary to have a society that brought economic justice to people, because only a society that brought economic justice would realize the dream that he had articulated in 1963. And so late in his life, he said, you know, the dream that I articulated, I see becoming a nightmare. And he's talking about later 1960, the turmoil, the Vietnam War, the riots in cities and so forth. And he was in a period of despair, I think, towards the end of his life.
Yeah, I get that from reading about him. Martin seemed to see in Jesus' invitation to Nicodemus that he must be born again, a similar invitation to entire societies, that their whole structure must be changed. How significant was this biblical story to Martin's work?
I think for him, it was a kind of metaphor for this kind of story in the Bible, representing a metaphor for the transformation not only of individuals, but more largely of societies.
Right. Now, I'm guessing that some of his religious pushback could be that hey, look, Jesus was talking about changing the inner person, and if everybody did that, societies would change. But Martin didn't see it quite like that. I think from your description of him religiously, he would see both, right? He would see,
yes,
personal change and systematic structural change. I think he would say, I think Jesus was saying both. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's exactly accurate. And the other thing that he was very influenced by Reinhold Niebuhr's book, Moral Man and Immoral Society. And Reinhold Niebuhr in this book asked the question, why do people who are good people, you know, are nice to their neighbors and give to local charities and so forth, but when they create societies, they create evil societies, immoral societies. How is that? And King is thinking about the segregated South is the Bible Belt South. How is it that the most Christianized region of the country has created this evil social system? And it's because people think that individual change will lead to social justice, and that's not how it actually works out in human life.
Okay. Second to last question. There was visceral religion in his last speech given at the Church of God in Christ in Memphis, which was the home church of the nation's largest Black Pentecostal denomination. That's fundamentalist, I think, right?
Yes. He
indicated that he had been to the mountaintop and seen the promised land, and that, quote, we as a people will get to the promised land. I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord, close quote. Based on your understanding, Paul, of African-American religious history and American history, what did he mean then, and what have these words meant since he uttered them? So two questions there.
Yeah, I think that he meant that his religious vision remained what it was in spite of his despair, in spite of the fact in this particular case, he wasn't going to be there. Like he was trying to go to bed early, take the night off. But the people were demanding him, so they called him, and he showed up, and he had to give, he ended up, and this happened to him several times in his life. He gave one of his most magnificent speeches completely off the cuff. But he could do that because he had all these images that he returned to, one of which was, I've been to the mountaintop. He used this image in various other speeches. But here he uses it the most perfectly to end a speech in which he is addressing the very real problems of dealing with the garbage workers' strike in Memphis. And he had a lot of very specific things to say about that. And he had the whole episode in Memphis in the spring of 1968 had been really very difficult. And there was some violence that had happened the month before, and he was very worried about that happening again. But somehow at the end, he says, I still have this vision. I've been to the mountaintop. And like he knows that the perfect world is not going to come in his life. He doesn't know he's going to die the next day, of course. But he knows that the perfect world is not going to come in his life, but that he can see it coming down the road, and that we as a people will get there someday.
And what have these words meant since that time, especially, let's say, in the last 3 years?
I think what has meant since that time is just what he meant, the same thing that it meant at that time, which is that, as Frederick Douglass put in the 19th century, without the struggle, there is no progress. And you might say, without a vision, the people perish, right? The biblical passage that mentions that from the Old Testament. And so the vision is of the promised land that will never get there in some perfect sense, but that the vision is necessary to inspire people to do things that they would not do otherwise to move a society towards social justice.
Thank you. That was helpful. One quick question before the last one that I ask all guests. Do you think that Americans then, let's just keep in the historical context, Americans then, religious Americans will say, or maybe just any Americans, viewed him as a prophet? Now, that word is loaded, but I mean in the way of an Old Testament, let's say an Old Testament prophet. Did people, American, a general, an average American, let's say, who wasn't a Black Baptist, did they somehow view him as a national religious figure, as a national prophet in any way? Does that question
make sense? No, they did not. Obvious exceptions. Black Americans did, of course. Not all Black Americans, but a large segment of the Black American community did. A small segment of white Americans did, a small segment of liberal Protestant ministers. But, you know, if you look at the coverage of him at the time of his death, like in a popularity poll, he would not rank very high. A lot of people saw him as a kind of agitator whose time had come and gone, and someone who'd given one great speech in 1963, but now was sort of too big for his britches or something like that. And he was viewed quite unfavorably, really, at the time of his death. Not at all as a prophet.
Okay. I did a podcast interview with Melissa Mathis about her book, When Sorrow Comes, and she has a chapter about how the nation dealt with many crises, how the clergy dealt with them. And one chapter was about how Americans and the clergy dealt with JFK's death and how they dealt with MLK's death, and quite different. And some of what you said reminded me of that. Okay, Paul, as we conclude, do you want to share any lessons or takeaways from the book, either in terms of important historical transformations you were charting, or importantly, in terms of helping us better understand our present moment in the American narrative?
So I think the point that I would want to make is that whether you read my book or any number of other biographies of King that you could read, by the way, since I did my book, there's a book by Jonathan Eich called King Alive, very long, 600 something page book that is, I think, now the best existing kitchen sink and all biography of King. But he makes, and many of us have made the same point, which is that King's life has been reduced to a couple of phrases in one speech on August 28, 1963. And in order to understand King, we have to not reduce him to that, but to understand his prophetic message about social justice, a prophetic message that holds true today. And I hoped my book could be one contribution in communicating the larger and more complex sense of King's message to a public that is largely subjected to oversimplified accounts of King's life now.
Okay, thank you. You have the last word. We have been talking with Paul Harvey, Distinguished Professor of History and Presidential Teaching Scholar at University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, and the author of Martin Luther King, A Religious Life. Listeners, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcast fix. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. Paul, thank you so much for doing your best to equip us to better comprehend and perpetuate the American project by understanding how religion, fueled by the idea of religious freedom as found in the U.S. Constitution, played a role, an important role, in the life of Reverend Martin Luther King, one of America's most significant preacher activists. It was informative and enlightening. I hope you enjoyed the time with us as well.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really enjoyed this.
The podcast series, Religion in the American Experience, is a project of the National Museum of American Religion. Episodes will be released monthly on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.